Hey, everybody, welcome to the show. I'm Gustavo, the host of the Enabled Disabled podcast. We are excited to welcome Steve Schweier back on the show for the second time. Steve, this is the first time we've had a repeat guest. I'm super excited to have you back on the show. Wow. Steve is the author of On the Vertigo. He has done an incredible amount of work raising awareness for Meniere's disease. If you haven't checked out the first episode, please do. A brief description of myself. I am a middle-aged Brazilian man with short black hair combed to the front. I've got a blue polo shirt on. I am in my conference room right now at work with some beige walls and some photographs of some of the work we've done. So Steve, welcome to the show, man. Welcome back.
Wow. I had no idea that I'm your first repeat offender. I like that. It makes me feel important. I'm in my bedroom. I'm in my bed where I spend most of my time, or on the couch. It's a cluttered bedroom, but I have plants around and stuff like that. And I'm just sitting on my bed and my phone's propped up on my pillow. I've got reading glasses on so I can see you. I've got short dark hair and I've got headphones on so that I can hear you clearly and you're getting a good audio. So yeah, thanks for having me on again.
You're welcome. You're always welcome back on here. It's a pleasure. So I have a lot to ask you about. And since the last time we met, I have read your book, which was phenomenal, which we're going to get into. But first of all, can you give us a recap of what you've been up to, what you've done, you know, what's going on in your life since the last time you were on the show?
Yeah, a lot. A lot. I had just put the book out when I was on your show the first time. The book had just come out. And I wrote it about a bike trip I took between Denver and Columbus, Ohio. And so it's the story of that trip. And it also has some background on me. And it also has my brother Dave's voice. He writes some stuff in there. After that, once the book came out, we decided we're going to do another trip and we're going to start a nonprofit. So we've been fairly busy, and the nonprofit was okayed by the IRS while we were on our trip to San Francisco from Colorado again. So we came back and got the letter, and that was good news. And it just snowballed into the nonprofit. So, you know, two trips down in a book, and now the nonprofit's up and running. And, you know, I've just got a great board of directors, a great team surrounding the nonprofit that they're hands-on and involved. And, you know, I'm doing my part and I'm the face of the nonprofit, but I've just got a fantastic board of directors that's working their tails off, getting the websites up and running and trying to get corporate contacts and stuff and a LinkedIn page up and going. And, you know, it's just a lot of the business aspects of the nonprofit. And it's a lot of work, but it's rewarding. And I'm hoping that it'll just give us the next jump up to be able to make a bigger and bigger difference.
Phenomenal. Is the nonprofit, what's the name of the nonprofit?
On the Vertigo. And it's a 501c3, so we can give tax deduction for anybody who donates. Our website is onthevertigo.org. That's simple. So all one word, onthevertigo.org. And there you'll find all the information about me and what we do as a nonprofit. And there's also links to, like, your Enabled Disabled podcast is linked in there. And, you know, other resources that I feel are important to me and to what we're doing. So there's just a ton of information there. All the videos we've posted are there, pictures, newspaper articles, any, all my podcasts are on there. So yeah, so it's a lot of information. That's really good. Hopefully it'll help people steer, you know, hopefully people can get steered into the right direction if they find me and they have Meniere's disease, which is a vestibular disorder that gives you vertigo and dizziness and nausea and balance issues and hyperkosis and problems with your eyes, light sensitivity. So there's a lot of symptoms, and it's scary to when you first get it, your whole life changes. And so if people have Meniere's and they find my site, then I want them to be able to be directed to really good resources that will help them even more.
And what is the main purpose of the nonprofit is to raise awareness for Meniere's disease, educate people? And are you trying to, and you're raising money to help find better treatments? What's the, Okay.
Yeah. It's all that in one ball. And like one of the things I've been doing lately is trying to narrow down our mission so that we have a product to sell, because right now it's, you know, I've done bike trips and I wrote a book and we started a nonprofit, but you know, people are only going to donate if they see what we're doing and how we plan on doing it, you know, something that they can get behind and be like, hey, this is a rare disease. Yeah. I'd like to support this and it's tax deductible, but yeah, it's mainly raising awareness, giving people resources from our website, and then raising money for research. And then as our board of directors will decide how we're going to allocate the different finances. Right now, we don't have a ton of money. You know, we're still at the startup point. Yep. So we're planning on hopefully grabbing some bigger corporate dollars, and then we can make a bigger difference.
Absolutely. Hopefully part of that awareness raising too would come from, I know on your book, you mentioned that, you know, you saw 9 doctors trying to get the right diagnosis, trying to figure out what was going on. Nobody was really helping you either because they weren't specialized for, you know, various reasons. But when you found that 10th doctor and things clicked and you finally started to see some improvements or at least some stabilization, that, you know, how that's so important. And I would hope that you guys are also going to help educate and raise the awareness for more of the medical community, so more people can understand what it is and what's going on and how they can treat it.
Absolutely. I have a lot of people that around the world that bought a copy of the book just to give to their doctor, because most of the time, and what I've found until my 10th doctor, and it was 3 years and through 9 doctors, that I knew more about what was wrong with me than they did. You know, I mean, they could run tests on me and tell me, yeah, you have a balance problem, but for me, I'm living it every day. So, you know, it's like getting from A to B. And that 10th doctor was the guy who settled it down, and we started working a program to get me to where I could be up and functioning again. And that was losing my job, losing playing music. You know, I lost everything. And so it was just important to get back up and just start being upright and being able to get out of bed each day and do something, you know.
You went on this first trip, this first bike ride, and I want to talk about both of them, because I'm interested. I still don't know, you know, some of the things that happened on the second ride and how that was, but the first book, I don't know if you're going to do another one, but it's a gripping read. I could not put it down. The first kind of thing that I want to talk about was, when did you start to realize, when you approached people? I know you'd say in the book, for example, that obviously you're riding for days, you're at a campgrounds. It's not like you're staying in luxury hotels and chilling out, like you're riding 100 miles a day, right? You guys look, you and your team, your brother and the couple friends that went on the trip, actually had 2 brothers that went on the trip. You know, you're looking rough around the edges, and you know, when you approach people, how did you approach people to start telling your story? And when did you start to realize just how generous and receptive and helpful, you know, so many people were being?
Well, first of all, I attract a lot of attention because I have lots of tattoos and I like to wear skulls, and, you know, I'm not a goth guy, but I'm a rocker guy. So, you know, I dress in black t-shirts, and, you know, I don't mind wearing ripped jeans. I don't dress to impress. The first 3 days of the first ride was more getting my feet wet. It was just head to the grindstone. Can I do this? You know, 100 miles today, camp, 100 miles, camp, 100 miles, camp. Then we took a day off, and we went, and it's in the book. We went into a diner, and it was there was only one other table full of people, and they were all in their 70s. And I walked by, and I could just tell there was a curiosity about me, because this is a town with like 1,800 people in it or something, if I remember. Super small farm town in the middle of Kansas, nowhere. And then I come in looking like, what? I mean, I drew attention. Then they invited me to sit with them and have coffee, and we chatted. And I just found that if I just told my story and what I was doing and why I was doing it, people just gravitated to it. They just, they clutched on to my story. And like I say in the book, you know, I got done having a 2-hour breakfast with them, and every one of them donated money to my cause. And they don't, you know, I'm a stranger off the street. So that was the first time I really knew that, okay, my plan just has to be real, be myself, you know. And I would just drive through towns and talk to people at gas stations. And, you know, my e-bike has stickers all over it, and that attracts attention, and it's pink. So what's this guy riding a pink, crazy electric bike doing in my town? And so people would just come up and look at my bike and be like, wow, you know, is that one of those newfangled electric bikes? Boom, doors open. I tell them, hey, I'm riding all the way to Columbus, and they just gravitated towards it. So it's nothing special, that no special gift I have. It's just, I think just being myself was enough.
Yep. Well, and it's interesting that you're being yourself, but it's also sparking people's curiosity, right? Like you said, like, who is this? Who is this guy I've never seen before riding into town with this interesting looking bike and, you know, rocker dude. And, you know, like, what's going on here? So you're inviting them to talk to you. You're inviting conversation.
Yeah. And one of the most exciting things when I look back on it, you know, those things are kind of individual things that happened. But when I look back at the trip as a whole, I hung out with Harley people that were riding Harleys, you know, and drinking beer with them and chatting them up. And then the next night, I'm spending the night in a church in the pastor's side yard. And it's like, I had the whole gamut, and I just loved meeting the people. You know, I talked to homeless people. I talked to, you know, blue collar people. I talked to white collar people. So when I look back at the trip as a whole, it just encompasses that humanity is humanity. And like I've told you before, you know, everybody has some issue that they have to deal with, whether it's a bad marriage or a crippling disabling disease like I have, or the handicap that you deal with every day. It could be, you know, a troubled child. You know, your child is a teenager and he's getting into trouble, you know, that all those things happen to everybody. So just being real and being honest about what I struggle with, it connects your souls in a way that is what I think makes humanity one of the greatest things, the greatest things about humanity.
Yeah. And you're authentic about it. I started a YouTube channel recently. We've posted some podcast episodes, and we're going to be doing some other videos. But one of the things that I'm struggling with or trying to get better at, right, is to show more aspects of myself, my life, my whole body, right? People only see me kind of from the neck up right now on the podcast. It's not easy to put yourself out there, like your whole self, your whole being, right? I was pretty amazed that how vulnerable you were willing to get on that first bike ride, especially when you chose to, when you had a vertigo attack. You know, you chose to record that. You manned up and you showed it and you talked about it as you were experiencing it. That's an unbelievable act of courage. And thank you for doing that. But like, did you know, you know, ahead of time, if this happened, you were going to do it?
Oh yeah. We discussed that. The whole team discussed that on the first 3 days while we were settling in. And they would, I would get done with 100 miles and collapse into my camp chair and just look like shit, just wiped out. And then, you know, they were like, oh, you know, we want to ask you some questions, but not if you're not feeling like it. And then I made the decision, no, we're filming everything, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And that vertigo attack was a brutal one. And it was in a strange place, in the parking lot of a church, you know, in the sun, on the hot asphalt. And there's writing that chapter was probably the hardest part of the book. Like, that was the most, it probably took me days to write that one chapter because I kept revisiting it. And when you revisit it and you're actually putting it on paper, man, it just drives really deep into, you know, it's like it's happening again. And so it was actually easy to write about, but emotionally it took a toll to have to write that chapter. But that's the most commented on chapter of the whole book. You know,
you could have backed out from when you were on the trip, right? You could have shown everything else and you could have backed out of filming that vertigo attack. You could have even written about it and nobody would have thought any less of you because of that. Nobody would have said you're less courageous or you backed out of this. Like, it was perfectly okay not to do it. So in that moment, it's powerful and it shows who you are as a human being that you still chose to do it, right? Yeah. Like no matter what. So I commend you for that.
Well, I think it was just as hard on my brothers. Dave and Brian were there, and Brian's son Emmett was there. And I think it was hard on them because I don't think they wanted to film it. Yeah. They were just like, oh my gosh. And I'm just like, no, grab the camera and we're going to show the world what a vertigo attack looks like and what it feels like. And it's horrible. It's just a horrendous place to be in your headspace. And I know a lot of people that have had dizzy spells and stuff, but an actual vertigo attack, it's unlike anything that you ever feel. It's surreal. You know, you just kind of black out and your mind is sharp, but you're floating. It's a very difficult thing to explain.
You described it really well in your book. I can only imagine what it's like based on that description, but it was very detailed, very descriptive, very powerful. Like, I would encourage people, if there's no other reason, to buy On the Vertigo, buy it for that, because there's a lot of deep, powerful lessons there. When you said that you had to learn to not fight it, to just let it go and just be within it, that's some Zen Buddhism right there. That's some deep enlightenment of what you're going through and who you are and how to get through it.
Yeah, it was no fun, but I'm glad I recorded it. And I'm glad I wrote about it in the book, because like you said, you know, I could have just shown the positives and the stuff that was going on that were good. But, you know, during that trip and the second one, there was really good days. And there was days where I just wanted to quit. You know, I mean, twice on the second trip, I pulled my bike over. I was by myself in the middle of the desert, pulled my bike over, put the kickstand down and just sat down and cried. You know, I'm done. But after throwing a little fit, you hop back on your bike and start pedaling and put in another 50 miles and call it a day. So I don't know. It's my personal challenge. You know, nobody would blame me for quitting or stopping or anything, you know, especially if they have a vestibular disorder, because they realize how hard this is. But that's just not me. I don't like to lose. I'm super competitive and I just like to prove that I'm just going to challenge myself and do it.
Yep. And you, in the book, it's really interesting that kind of usually at the end of every chapter or most of the chapters, you know, you're kind of giving the disease a fuck you. You're saying like, I won today. I still went through it. Yeah. You know, yeah. it's you call it a monster, and the monster is always there and it's always lurking and it's a part of you, but your purpose and your drive is to just keep showing up and be just as consistent and be just as present and to keep at it. Right. So it's not beating you. You're just as constant of a presence, right? That there's this struggle, but also, I guess, sorry. So the two questions I want to ask you is, number one, has that struggle, the way you're framing it in your mind, the way you're thinking about it and living it, has that changed at all? Is it still the monster? Are you still seeing it the same way? Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Okay. Like it every day that I make it through a day, I do that up to the sky, just like, you know, like it's like you said, you know, I just give my disease a fuck you. Like I beat you today, you know, and you're not going to keep me down. And you know, it's funny. Cause when I was writing that, I'm like, people are going to think I'm making this up. You know, there's no way he crawled into his tent after riding 100 miles and he literally would flip off his disease, but I did it and I still do it today. You know, it's just my way of compartmentalizing it, I guess, to a degree, because it does feel like it's a haunting thing that just like it's a dark cloud that just fills my head. And I always feel like it's trying to wrap me up and make me dizzy. And my brain can be clearer sometimes if I don't have brain fog. So it's not like I'm having hallucinations that this is a real monster. But for me, I can compartmentalize it by saying, okay, my disease is what's making me dizzy today. My disease is what's keeping me in bed today. And it's not my fault, you know? So I can't take the blame for having a disability. And that was something I had to work through for the first 10 years was, how do I get through without this thing crushing me every day and keeping me in bed and keeping me depressed? And I think the first bike trip was the first time I was just like, okay, now it's time to fight. It's me against you. You know, what can I do while you're making me sick? What can I accomplish, if anything, while I feel this bad? But let's go see, because now it's on. You know, I'm done caving to what I think the monster wants me to do, which is suffer all the time. And I hate that fact. So yeah, kind of put the gloves on and let's go out there.
In the ring. But you also said in the book, for me, it was the most powerful line, that you also learned to love yourself.
Yeah. Yeah. That's at the very end.
Yeah.
Yeah. It took that whole trip for me to come to that realization, because during the, you know, when I'm on my bike for 100 miles, it's just me in my head, you know? So I had a lot of time to think and a lot of time to scrapulate through why I'm doing this trip, why I feel certain ways. And I worked through a lot of stuff personally. You know, I'm glad that people followed the trip, and I'm glad that they got inspired to maybe go out and walk around the block when they haven't left their house in 3 years. You know, that makes me feel good. But the trip was a mental readjusting. You know, is the monster still out there? Yes, he is. But at least now I can kind of compartmentalize, like I said. And, you know, I don't have to carry the burden of my disease the way I thought I was going to have to for the rest of my life. And so that first trip, it did change my perspective on just being okay, being sick. It's okay. You're sick. I'm going to be sick the rest of my life. This is chronic dizziness. This is, you know, this is a chronic disabling disease I have, and it's not going to go away. So what do? You got to learn to live with it. So, yeah.
So you're learning to live with it. You're putting your feet in the ring again. You're back in the game, but you're also you're not feeling, I'm asking here because I'm not quite sure. Like when you say you learn to love yourself, is that you talk in the book about how, you know, it's there's a sense of maybe it's shame, maybe it's humiliation to ask for help or to get sick or to need this assistance. Is that where you learn to accept that's okay and that doesn't make you any worse of a human being? Am I going in the right direction there?
Yeah, and you know, the stuff I deal with physically is very difficult, but the stuff I have to deal with emotionally, like you said, guilt, shame, insecurity, self-worth, I mean, that's where the real battle is. I've come to the grips with this is how I'm going to feel physically. But to be honest, Gustavo, I'm not okay being sick. I'm not okay. I'm just not okay with this. I don't agree that this is the way I should have to live. You know, I of course I challenge it. I challenge the monster, but I'm not okay with it. And maybe I will be someday, but the way it affects my wife, you know, she watches me suffer and that's super hard for her. Like I hate that she has to watch me suffer because I can't not suffer and she can't not see it. And so there's this dichotomy that goes into every marriage with certain disabilities that it's just as hard, if not harder, on the spouse. You know, she has to suffer with me by watching me suffer. And it's not fair. It's not right. It pisses me off. But we've been married for 25 years and, you know, she's stuck by me for 10 years with me being sick and hopefully we'll make it to the end. But yeah, like you said, I'm still coming to grips with a lot of the emotional stuff. And I think I might deal with that the rest of my life too.
You know. It's a process, and I hope you do. I'm interested, and I want to see how that evolves. And I'm talking it through more when you're meeting with other people, because you met some people for the first time on that first trip who also had Meniere's disease, yeah. And you talked to them. Did they have similar experiences with their spouses, or does the same kind of shared frustrations and difficulties?
Yeah, absolutely. Yep, for sure. And meeting other people with Meniere's for the first time after having it for 10 years and never having heard of it before I got it was a really interesting experience. Sue Ensley and I can't think of her name right now. Shoot, Amanda Jew in Dayton, Ohio. You know, sitting with someone where I can just look into their eyes and know how they feel and hear what's going on in their head. That was a surreal experience. And it was very healthy. You know, it was healing. And my disease is invisible. I don't have anything that would let anybody know that I have this horrible disease. You know, if I could crack my head open and just let it show, you know, it would probably be easier. But being with someone who knows what it feels like in my head and conversing about it was very healing for me. So that was one of the reasons I wanted to meet people with my disease.
I'm sure it was healing for them too. And that has to be powerful to meet somebody who's going through the same thing and being able to connect in that way. What would you say as you moved on to the second trip? Because the second trip you went out west instead of going east, right? So you had to go through. I remember getting a text message from you about not having very much fun in the desert. So that was that was. Can you tell us, like, maybe give us what were some of the moments there that were most memorable that built upon this self-understanding and this appreciation and this acceptance of yourself that happened on the second trip that maybe surprised you or just built upon what you already knew?
Deciding to do the second trip was tough because I knew what I'd be getting into. The first trip, I just won it and I had no idea what I was getting into. And so it was just all, can I do it physically? Can I ride my bike 100 miles a day? Can I camp most nights in a tent when I feel like shit? You know, so that trip I went in very stupid, and I kind of liked going in stupid because with the second trip, I knew what I was going to be getting myself into. I knew what it was going to be like to camp in my tent. I knew what 100 miles feels like on an e-bike. I know what the weather was going to be, headwinds, because I'm heading west and I hate headwinds. You know, reading the book, I hate headwinds. It can break me down mentally. So it was more of a mental battle the second trip going west, because going through the Midwest, you know, there's little towns all over the place. And then you go west and there's nothing. I mean, I spent two states, Utah and Nevada, on what's called, it's Route 50. It's called the loneliest road in America. And it says it on the sign. And there is nothing out there. There is nothing. So it's not like I see some trees and I can be like, oh, I'm going to come up here and sit in the shade and maybe talk to the farmer, or go pull into this little town and sit in a cafe. And, you know, this was, you're on your bike and literally the road is bone straight for 20 miles and then it goes up and over a mountain pass. But you see that mountain pass, and I know it's 4 hours of just riding towards it before I'll get there. And that was like a mental jack up, you know, because you just stare at that pass for 4 or 5 hours and you're just riding in the same straight line. So it could get discouraging. So that was different than the first trip. The first trip had more nature and stuff. This was desert, straight up desert. But then once we got to Carson City and got into Lake Tahoe, the whole trip kind of spun in a really positive way, because I was kind of getting discouraged. But two of my friends, Mark and Bill, showed up on their motorcycles to finish the trip with us. My wife obviously was riding her bike with me when she could. But once we got to Tahoe and we got back into a mountain scenario, like where I live, I felt it lifted my spirits, having my friends just show up out of the blue. My brother Brian flew back in to drive the van so my wife could ride her bike more. So all these things kind of came together at Carson City that just kind of gave me a second wind. And that's gave me the push to go over, you know, get it done. But yeah, the desert was just horrible. There's just nothing out there.
It's a desert's a tough, that's a tough climate to ride. How are you able to plan for the battery changes in the desert when there's just nothing out there? Was it just a matter of taking more batteries with you and charging them in the van?
Yeah, we just, you know, whoever was driving the van, my brother Brian or whatever, he would know about how far our batteries would go. So yeah, we had to plan a little bit more, but there was only like one day where I got stuck without having a battery, and I was only like 3 miles from where we were going to stay for the night. So I just called and said, come and get me, you know? So the first trip I rode every inch, you know, that was my goal. And this trip, there was three times where I literally put my bike in the van, and I did it once for a whole entire day after our van broke down. I didn't want my wife and son to be stranded in the desert. So I took a whole 100 mile day and just drove that 100 miles in the van with them and with my bike in the back, just because I didn't have to prove that. I didn't have to prove I could, you know, like the first trip I felt I had to prove I could do every inch or I wouldn't be okay with it. Where this trip, there was a time where we were going around a reservoir, you know, a big reservoir, and there was two lanes, super skinny. It was holiday weekend. There was cars and trucks, and we came around the corner and I'm like, nope, hell no. I'm not riding my bike on that is like so dangerous, and this is the only way through. So my brother Brian and I threw the bike in the van and we drove that little stretch for 10, 15 miles around the reservoir. and then pulled it back out and I took off again. So like I gave myself more grace on this trip, where the first trip I just had a lot more to prove to myself, where this time it was more like, you know, I have my wife's riding a bike with me a lot of the time, you know, so that, you know, that stress of making sure she's safe as semis are just blasting by us, you know. Of course, we got bright vests on and stuff, and we're safe as we can be, but it's scary. I mean, this trip had a lot more scary times where I felt like, oh, this is a really bad, dangerous situation that me and my wife are riding in right now, you know. So that was, it caused some anxiety. And then the van broke down twice, and that added some anxiety, you know, because we just bought this van like 3 weeks before we left, and it was specific for us to do these bike trips. And, you know, it's just old. It's a 93 old beat up van, but I love it. We call it the Blue Whale because it's just a mammoth van. And yeah, so there was stress on that too. You know, is the van going to make it each day, you know? So there was just more mental stresses that made it difficult.
I'm glad you gave yourself that grace because, I know that when you would cross a bridge or you'd get into certain towns that were more populated, you were definitely fearing for what could happen and what could go wrong in the first book, but you were determined to do it anyways. I'm glad that you stepped away from that a little bit on the second one, because like you said, you already proved that you could do that. You didn't have to do it again. And just curiosity here, you mentioned in the book that bananas are an important part of your diet. Why do you not like them? Because I don't think I've ever met somebody that like can't stand bananas.
I heard someone say this last week on a TV show, and I can't remember what it was. But anyway, they said exactly what I tell people. It's not a taste thing. It's a texture thing. Okay. I have to force it down because it's just like I say in the book, it's like chewing a dog turd to me. It's just, they're gooey and it's a texture thing. I like the, like bananas. I like the flavor of a banana, like banana gum or candy or suckers. But just eating a regular banana, it's just torture. I just have to choke it down. Gotcha. since that trip, I still eat, you know, I'm eating 3 or 4 bananas a week now, and I think it's helping.
Have you just tried to put it into a shake instead? Just blend it up so you don't have to eat it?
Yeah, it's just smoothies. It's just like you can have 20 strawberries, and if you put a piece of banana this big in it, tastes like to me is banana. It just drives me crazy. So it's me and the banana, we've made peace with each other, but we still don't get along too well. Gotcha. It's out of necessity.
I personally, by the way, if I was, again, I can't imagine myself doing that bike ride, but if I did it, I can tell you that my moment where I think I would have stopped was with the pig trucks, like, you know, like, no, thank you. I'm good. I'm going to pull over and we're going to call it today. I'm not going to put up with that.
There was Missouri was just miserable. The whole state, just beginning to end, it rained every day. And it was cold and horrible. And then I didn't know this until I asked a gas station attendant. I'm like, what is up with all the flipping pig trucks and the hog trucks? And they're like, well, it's harvest time. You know, this is the time everybody's taking them to market. And I'm like, oh, so September is not the time to go through Missouri because there's pig trucks. I mean, they're just delivering their hogs, you know. That was actually when I decided to write the book. I wanted people to get something serious out of it, but I also wanted it to be funny. You know, I wanted it to be comical. Now, getting splashed in the back with pig shit, there's nothing funny about it. But in a way, there kind of is, because it's like I'm out there just getting blasted in the back, and it literally just stunk, you know? And so it's just, you just kind of have to laugh at that and just be like, that was just, you know, a silly situation. And it was fun to write about that. It was fun to write about the Doberman chasing me that came after me. You know, there was just a lot of things that just happened naturally that, when I was riding, I was like, oh my God, I remember that happening. This is, that was really funny, you know? So try and put my own spin on.
Yeah, I didn't know Dobermans could run that fast either. So that's good to know.
29.5 miles an hour. It's burned in my speedometer's burned in my head from seeing that, because I thought this thing's gonna rip me down.
Yep. I'm glad you made it through that, but I did not know they were that fast, but clearly they can't keep up the pace as long as you can.
Yeah. And my e-bike max is at 30 miles an hour, unless I'm going downhill. So on a flat, you know, the fastest I can go is 30 miles an hour. And that thing was right next to me before it gave up. So it was crazy.
It was also really cool how you threw in the some of the interesting scenery and where you got to go and shoot hoops in the place where they filmed Hoosiers, right? Those are some really nice touches in there.
Yeah, that was magical for me, because I'm just such a sports freak. You know, I can't play a lot of sports anymore except golf, but yeah, that was special. And just stumbling on it, you know, I had no idea, it just showed up, and there was a lot of magical stuff on that. Second trip didn't have as much of those kind of cool discovery thing, but there was definitely some fun stuff on the second trip, and funny stuff too. I'll tell you a story later.
Okay. And how was the, when you went, so you went all the way to California, were you able to, and on the end of the first trip, you met the mayor of the, remind me of the city in Ohio?
Westerville.
Westerville. Thank you. Did something similar happen, or did you build any, I know you've built all this momentum and like you said, the On the Vertigo is like an established brand now. You're making headway. There's no headwind right now, it's mostly tailwind. Did something happen kind of climactic like that on the second trip?
No, Carson City was probably when my brother flew back in and my friend showed up. That was a good turning point, a really, really positive turning point. And we had a lot of fun after that. You know, the desert was a struggle, but after that, it was the scenery was better. You know, there was more people, really good bike path system in a lot of California, like going through Sacramento and going through north of San Francisco and dropping down. You know, the bike paths were really well done. So it felt safer too. You know, I felt safer if I could spend most of my day on a bike path, obviously. So yeah, those were positives.
Awesome. And I know that the last time we spoke, we were talking about, you were just, again, it was unreleased, or they had just only released the first episode, but you were on the Life Rebalance Chronicles, you know, Kimberly Warner Unfixed Media did that. What was your experience like with that? And what were some of the feedback that you heard from people that watched it?
Oh, people loved it. And I've actually made a lot of contacts with people through that watched it and then contacted me and said, hey, this really helped me. And you know, this is what I needed to see, because I felt so alone and isolated. And now I don't feel so, you know, caged in by my vestibular disorder. So yeah, tons of good feedback. It was really fun. Of course, you know, working with Kimberly is just a pleasure. And you know, she's just a little snot rag that just me and her poke each other constantly. We never, you know, we talk about serious things, but we just poke each other and make fun of each other constantly. And it's a really fun relationship to have with her. And so, like we said earlier, before we came on the air, you know, me and you are going to be in the next Unfixed episode, and that's Kimberly Warner doing it. And so I'm excited to be a part of that with you.
Me too. No, Kimberly's phenomenal. All the people that I've met that have been on her documentaries have been phenomenal human beings. And it's just great to, she has a nose for picking out the people that are going to be featured. She's quite good judge of character, but also just, you know, she's bringing some great people together in her movies.
Yeah, I like that.
That's good to hear. So I also really liked on the book how, I'm glad that Dave, your brother, wrote the chapters parts of them, and you got it. We got to hear his perspective and what he was worried about and what some of his experiences were. Maybe one day he could be on the show as well, but you both became a lot closer after that trip and bonded, and he understood on a much deeper level what you were going through. So kind of, what can you share a little bit, talk a little bit more about that, and share how important it is for parents, for friends, for family to not fear, to not pull away from people when they're going through that it's, you know, they should do the opposite. There's nothing to, it's not easy, but there's so much potential there for understanding, for growth, for just bonding as human beings.
Yeah, I could speak on that for hours, because my brother and I, Dave and Brian, you know, we're all close. We've always been close. You know, they know my battles to a degree, and I just love them both. And we also have an older sister, Karen, who lives in Denver. But with Dave on the trip, it was the first 3 days were very important, because Bill was riding his Harley, Dave's driving the van, Bryce was in his pickup truck. And so we had a good team to start with. But like I write it out in the book, that there's times where they would see me after 10 miles and just want to pull me off the bike, because they're just like, he's killing himself, or he looks like he's dying, or, you know, we have to stop, hit this madness. And it gave us a chance to communicate, and it helped me explain to them, no, I'm good. I will let you know if I can't ride. And which there were times where I quit early on certain days when I couldn't ride physically. But it took a few days for Dave to trust what I was telling him. You know, he's like, oh, you're trying to be Superman. And, you know, I could see in his head that he's just like, oh, he's in over his head, and I need to stop him. But it gave us a chance to communicate, and it gave me a chance to explain to him, this is what my days are like. You know, I'm like this all the time, whether I'm home on the couch or on my bike riding 100 miles. There's no difference. It's still me suffering and trying to get through the day, feeling as best I can. And so it took a little while for him to trust that. And we became closer, because, you know, it allowed me to show him what it's like to live like with Meniere's disease all day, every day. You know, he'd come and visit me and see me sometimes, and sometimes I was sick and sometimes I wasn't, but he was in charge of getting me to Columbus from Denver. So he felt a huge responsibility. And that was, I know that made it difficult on him mentally. It's like my wife on the second trip was with me the whole trip. And she's just like, man, I don't know if I could watch you do that again. I don't know if I want to be a part of that, because it's hard to watch. You know, it's like, it's stressful. It stresses me out when you're riding your bike in traffic, you know, and you could fall over or crash. You know, she's just like, it's stressful. And so for Dave, that trip was stressful, but he worked through that stuff, and we worked on it together, and it built a better trust. Yep. And now he's 50% of On the Vertigo. He does all the computer stuff still for the nonprofit. You know, we have a guy named Jeremy who's a computer guru, and him and Dave have been working endlessly to get this website up and running. And Dave, through that trip also, started following some of my Meniere's groups and my support groups, and he's come into contact, and now he has friendships in my community that are very tight, and they trust Dave as being part of On the Vertigo. You know, I'm in private groups that are just private for Meniere's people, but they let Dave come in and be it part of the group, so he can see what we're talking about and the issues we're dealing with. And he's ass deep into Meniere's disease stuff right now. And I totally appreciate that about him, because I can't do a lot of these things that he does for On the Vertigo. And like you said, I think the book is better for having Dave's voice in it. I think it just threw a really cool angle on the whole trip that Dave could comment and share his thoughts, because like you said, it's It's about other people, family members, brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles, you know, believing what we are saying, you know, and it's just so important to, I thought it was so important to have Dave's voice and his perspective on it.
And to see in the book and to read about that, trust, right? The trust of the, to say you're going through this, it's risky, but we're doing it. And I trust you, Steve, that when you say you can't do it today, you can't do it today. And until you tell me that, I'm not going to stop you. I'm not going to get in your way. That's huge. Like I tell coworkers and good friends, and my brother growing up with me picked up on that, but it's a huge turning point when people understand, hey, you know, I walk differently. Like I don't need help to do a bunch of things. When I do need help, trust me that I will ask you for it. I'm not ashamed to ask you for the help. I'm not gonna, unless I have something to prove, I'm not gonna fight with something that I don't need to fight with. But having that trust and that understanding where people know, people respect that is huge. It feels like you're being heard and listened to and accepted.
Yeah, and the thing with Dave was, you know, it wasn't always a hug fest every day. You know, it wasn't, you know, there's a lot of times where we would just get done and just, we'd have to go to our separate corners because we did get in a couple tiffs. And, you know, when you take on a challenge like that, that it just seems so like a Mount Everest thing, you know, there's going to be times where we disagree or we have different judgment calls that we're doing, or, you know, one day Dave just, he didn't feel appreciated and I didn't know he was feeling that way. And so, you know, we got a little tiff and it took us some to work through to for me to explain to him, no, I appreciate every single thing you're doing. I just don't show it all the time because that's just, you know what I'm saying? It's just, I never once took any of my team members for granted, you know, but yeah, maybe it looked like that to them. You know, if I just collapse and drink two beers and climb into my tent and just ignore everybody because that's what I had to do to survive that day or evening. So yeah, it's Dave and I, we get along really well. We still have our arguments and stuff like that, but it's just brother and brother, you know, it's not unhealthy.
Nope. That's how it is. No, I have the same experience with my brother and it's part of having a relationship, a meaningful relationship and connection with another human being.
Yeah. When we were teenagers, we'd beat the shit out of each other. Like literally, like, my mom would come home and there'd be blood on the kitchen floor, you know, and she's like, what the hell happened? And me and Dave are just full on fisticuffs when we were teenagers. You know, we had a lot of teenage angst and stuff like that. And we're very close in age. So, you know, there's a brotherly rival that sort of, but, you know, now it's, you know, we're not throwing punches or anything. We're just trying to help each other get through life.
Yeah. I mean, you've matured and you both matured and have different perspectives and that's that's teenagers are teenagers, you know, that happens.
And he right now is in the process of, on April 9th, we're having our first official nonprofit fundraiser at a golf course in Port Charlotte, Florida. And the Maple Leaf Golf and Country Club invited us to come and do a whole day shotgun, lunch, live music, silent auction, prizes, giveaways, trophies, and we're gonna do a whole golf day, 18 hole shotgun. So we're right now planning that for April. So that's gonna take up a lot of our time getting all that stuff set up. But I've got a great team on that, just like I do on my trips. It's like I'm surrounded by just people in that community where the golf course is at, and they're just being awesome. And my cousin Mary Lynn, who was in the book, her and her husband Jim, they live on that golf course now. And so they're working hands in hand with the staff there to get all this ball rolling with the golf outing. But I just wanted to mention that because
awesome. That's awesome.
I just got to get to Florida somehow. Not on my bike.
No. That's fantastic. What else can you talk about that you're planning with the foundation, or, you know, where other events or other activities, other ways to help raise awareness and move the needle?
One of the other things we're discussing, and like I said, we're just in our first month of starting up, you know, being an official nonprofit where we can give tax deductions and stuff like that. So we're just trying to get, right now we're just organizing, and all the board members are trying to find their niche and what they're best at. We got a guy that does marketing. We got a guy who does computers. And if you look at the board of directors, I'm super lucky because it's all top-notch people. Like, they're smart people, people that were CEOs, people that had their own companies. You know, I'm talking a lot of powerful people. So we're all just kind of trying to figure out how we reach out and how do we get this thing started. The golf thing is going to be our first official, but another idea we are throwing around is maybe doing a worldwide virtual bike tour where people can do it on their Pelotons or whatever at home. And, you know, they get donations if they can do so many miles on their bike in their bedroom, you know, but do it as a, not a competition, but as an event, you know, like a 6-hour event where people, you know, can you ride your bike for 6 hours straight? And if you do, you know, people can donate money to On the Vertigo. So that's another thing we have in our back pocket.
That's awesome. That sounds like a great idea and a great way to get more people involved and feel like they're doing something active, participating. I like that idea a lot.
Yeah, it's really good.
There might also be some, we'll talk offline, but there might also be some synergy there where you could potentially get have some artwork done that centers around, you know, you, your experience. I'm sure that I know one artist who is on the show and her episode's being released really soon, that she has some mental health issues, and she did, there's a couple actually, Elizabeth Jameson used to do that too, right? Where they kind of would take a MRI of the brains and then create a piece of artwork around it.
I like stuff like that, just that creativity. And, you know, that was one of the things that I really wanted to talk to you about and get your feedback on a little bit, if we have a minute.
Let's do it.
But like, along those lines, I lost being a musician. You know, I'm a bass player. I have been since fourth grade, and for the last 40 years, I've played in bands up until I got sick. Yesterday, for the first time in 4 years, I pulled my bass out and plugged it in and played a couple notes. And so it's got me thinking about losing passions to a disability. You know, like it was fine when I did it, but a couple hours after that, I broke down because it just crashed in what I lost. And it was hard to swallow. And so, like, I was listening to your interview with Hillary, and like, she has, her passion is like horses, and I listening to that made me think also, it's like, you know, how do I inspire people that lose passions to take a chance at stepping into the water a little bit again? You know, On the Vertigo, I've always wanted it to be something that inspires people to get out and maybe walk around the block or take a jog, or even just get in the car and go to the grocery, you know, baby steps physically. You know, don't let this keep you in the house, because Meniere's disease keeps a lot of people in the house 24/7. But after playing my bass, I think I need to add in a new angle to inspire people about what's it look like when you lose a passion, because I think they're in our DNA. I don't think I picked music to be passionate about. I think it picked me. It's in my DNA. You know, I think once, the first time I heard Led Zeppelin, you know, I was just like, I have to do that because it just made sense in my life. It was just a, you know, it just flowed out of me. So as far as losing passions and getting back into them, you know, what's your thought on passions and regaining them, losing them? Because losing playing my bass, it's mentally cripples me that I can't do that anymore.
So when you picked up the bass and you played a few notes, is it something that you when you started to play it, is it something that you think you just you want to play again and try again and just see what you can do with it? Or is it like why'd you pick it up? Were you curious?
I was talking to a good friend of mine. I call him Bones, and he's an artist. And this is what reminded me of when you talked about the lady that does the art. And he's got Meniere's disease, and he had to quit doing art because he couldn't hold the pencil still and he couldn't focus his eyes on the artwork. And he does really, really cool detailed dotting stuff like that. And, you know, it's a passion that he had that he can't do anymore. And so I told him, hearing you do that, I'm going to challenge myself and I'm going to plug my bass in for the first time in 4 years and play for 5 minutes and just doodle for 5 minutes and then just put it away and see how it feels, like how it affected me. And it affected me really hard. I cried buckets. And I think it's kind of grieving. It's that I'm having to grieve that loss. And maybe I've dealt with my issues with guilt and shame more than I've dealt with the passions I lost. So I don't know. I think it just kind of, it's in my mind right now, you know, like losing a passion, and can we regain it? And if we can't, what's it going to look like?
Yeah, I think that's it's a great question. And I haven't answered your question yet. So I'm going to take a stab at it. When I was younger, I used to play a lot of basketball. I used to play a lot of tennis. I loved both of those things tremendously. I don't play anymore for various reasons. I don't know. I think I could still do it if I really wanted to, but I don't know. My body's in a different place. You know, 40 years of wearing the prosthetics and takes a toll on the body. So for me, I've always loved swimming, but not the way I love it now. So swimming has become my substitute, and I'm exploring that. Yeah, I'm exploring that and enjoying it. And it's still challenging, but it's very different than those other sports. So I think part of my answer to that question is we're all capable of having more than one passion, and we can explore those different spaces. And there's, I think it's part of the process of aging where you can't do some of the things that you could do before, and that's okay, but there's other things to explore and learn about and enjoy in yourself. Another thought that comes to my mind is, because you were a musician and you're a really good musician, I actually enjoyed reading what you had to say about the music you were listening to and why you enjoyed it, right? And the Halls and Oates t-shirt. Like, so I think if you could explore in writing or in podcasts or on YouTube or your social media, the enjoyment that you still get out of listening to music and what music has meant for you in your life, I think you can inspire a lot of people into exploring music more deeply for the first time, because most people hear music in the background. They're not really sitting down and listening to it and having it, you know, get
envelop,
in here and
envelop,
so I think there's a lot of room there for you to share that love of music and appreciation for listening to music. Being born, so I have one arm. I could have played an instrument if I had really wanted to. I was not musically gifted in that way, but I never did, right? So for me, I channeled that love of music by learning to listen to it, learning to appreciate it. And that's part of what we do. Yeah, that's part of what I do in my business is creating music, you know, really phenomenal music reproduction systems for people in the hopes that they can find that love and that space of whatever it is. It can be comfort, it can be transformative, it can be challenging, but all of those things that I have come to learn and appreciate from music, I want to share that with other people too. Even though I can't play it.
Yeah, but like Bones, who's the artist, he lives in Switzerland. He doesn't play a musical instrument, but he's so passionate. And we talk about music all the time. There's another lady named Willow Gray that I'm friends with on Instagram and stuff. And she was a trained classical violinist. And she got Meniere's disease, hung her violin on the wall, literally hung it on the wall, and didn't take it down for years. And this week she picked it up and played. So stuff like that's important. But for me, I just wanted to see what it would feel like how it would affect me to play my bass, because I've spent so many hours and hours and hours on stage playing live. I'll never get to do that again. Being deaf in my left ear, and my right ear has hyperchosis, which is sensitivity to sound. It just doesn't sound right. I can't pick out the notes. And it just sounds like an AM radio, you know, kind of crackly AM radio. So, I mean, I don't think I could get back into playing to where I could enjoy it like I know I can. But listening to stuff, you know, like on my bike trips, I have headphones and my left ear is deaf and my right ear sounds like crap, but I love it so much. I just crank it up louder and just blast it in there and just try to capture that feeling again, you know, that I used to have with music. And so I never fell out of love with music, but it's just not the same, you know, it's just never going to be the same again. So, you know, I grieve that loss, but, you know, I don't know, taking a chance and plugging my bass in yesterday felt pretty good.
That's awesome. I'm glad you did that. And it's who knows, like, yeah, it's not going to be the same, but I would encourage you to just explore those other spaces that have opened up because of it. Right. Yeah. And you, in your perspective, your perspective, even as an adult, right. Your appreciation for yourself, for other people, for, again, I'm not trying to paint like a rosy picture, but you understand a lot more than most people do of what it means to be a human being, what it means to have empathy, what it means to be courageous, what it means to step into a new experience where you don't even know if you're going to make it through that day, right? So you've grown enormously as a person, and you've done that in part because of your disease, but also in part because of who you are. And so I would just encourage you to keep, one door closes and another door opens.
Yep. I say that in LRC and in one of the episodes, I say that, you know, it's up to me to open new doors, and who knows, it could go anywhere. On the Vertigo, I didn't think would go as big as it is, and it's just blown up, and I wasn't expecting that. And like I said, I don't put pressure on myself. It's going to go and it's going to morph into what it's supposed to be. It doesn't have to be what I want it to be. It needs to be what it's supposed to be. And right. It's like the book. I sat down just a journal, and 5 hours later, I looked up and I had 8 chapters written in 5 hours. And I'm just like, holy shit, I might have a whole book out of this if I keep doing this. But it wasn't that I intentionally decided to write the book. It just kind of started writing itself. And it was always 2 steps ahead of me. I always felt like I was trying to catch up to the story and explain things. And it was very healing, you know. And if I didn't, and if I never even published it and just put it under my bed, you know, the transcript, and just left it there, I would have come away a better person for writing it and just having vomited out all that information that I just had to get out. So I think music, I've kind of transferred that passion goes into writing now, because I love to write. It's hard, but it's my therapy. Like playing music used to be my therapy. Now writing is my therapy, because it allows me to get all that stuff out of me. So yeah. Who knows, maybe you've convinced me to do another book.
Do another book about, yeah, I think you should, or, you know, talk more about your appreciation. Again, for me, it was really enjoyable to read what you had to say about music, about listening to the music, about the songs that meant something to you, the movies that meant something to you. It's a part of this complex picture of who you are, and it brings you to life. And it's really, I think a lot of people are gonna take away a lot of things from that, from your writing.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. No, and yeah, I got some ideas about a second book. I just got to figure out, get it going. I think once I started, I think it'll write itself for the most part, and then the editing's going to suck. And I've got tons of stories from the second trip, and this is full circle, because I know you like funny stories and just stupid shit, and you know me, I'm just an idiot. So we're in Lake Tahoe. I'll try to make this really quick, but it was super funny. We're in Lake Tahoe. We found this little motel that was just perfect. It was like something out of a Stephen King book, you know, just kind of creepy hotel, but it was super comfortable and we loved it. So we decided, let's just take the whole day off the next day and enjoy just hanging out, not riding the bike and not just do nothing, the whole day off. So that being said, there was a Mexican restaurant right up the street. And since we didn't have to do anything the next day, me and my friend Bill and Mark and my brother Brian, we go to this Mexican restaurant at like 10 o'clock at night. We go 4 margaritas deep each. So we're 4 margaritas in. So we're kind of tying one on. I get the bright idea to make a movie spoof. So we thought, what would be super funny? It's like 2 in the morning, pitch dark, Lake Tahoe's all shut down, everybody's in bed, but our 4 drunk asses are out in the middle of the street. So I'm like, let's do the scene from Old School where Will Ferrell streaks, and he gets super excited. And he's like, let's go streaking, you know, and nobody goes with him. And he's just running down the middle of the street, buck naked. So I rip all my clothes off, and my brother films me streaking down the middle of Lake Tahoe. And the video is hilarious. So that, you know, we still had fun doing movie spoofs on that. But yeah, that was one of my funnier moments on that trip, because it was just ridiculously drunk stupidity. You know, I'm almost 55 years old, and here I am ripping my clothes off and running naked down the middle of Lake Tahoe.
Frank the Tank.
That's right. That's right. But I thought you'd get a kick out of that story. I thought of that this morning, and I was like, I got to tell you that on your show.
That's a great story. Hopefully you didn't, or, you know, did you run into anybody while running down the road?
Nope. We just filmed it and took about 30 seconds, and, you know, the video came out really, really funny. It's not X-rated, you know, but you can definitely tell I'm running down the street with no clothes on.
So that's awesome.
It's from the back.
Any White Castle on the second trip?
No, but I did have to hit my BW3s a couple times, because I absolutely love, that's my favorite, B-dubs. And yeah. So every time we went to like a bigger city like Provo, Utah, that's just south of Salt Lake City, the first thing I would do is look up the local BW3s. And I made the whole team eat BW3s so much in the first half of the trip that the second half of the trip everybody refused to go, my wife included. She's like, I've had enough, I'm not doing B-dubs anymore. But we don't have one where I live, so it's like White Castles. It's a, you know, I they're not available here, so when I get a chance, I hammer down some sliders.
Awesome. I think that's a perfect ending to the podcast. We're gonna go with that awesome story. Before we close out here, Steve, how can people reach out to you? How can people connect and learn more about you?
Super easy now. With the nonprofit, you can go to our website, onthevertigo.org, all one word, excuse me. Facebook is Meniers:onthevertigo. And you can follow me there on Facebook. Instagram is just on the vertigo, all lowercase, all one word. Instant message me from there. If you're on Facebook, I messenger a lot of people. That's how I keep in contact, and I share videos and, you know, discussions on Facebook Messenger mostly, because it's the easiest, and Instagram message. But Facebook, if you go on Facebook and find Meniers on the vertigo, you can contact me just by typing me a message. And I'm always up for hearing other people's stories and where they're at with their lives and stuff like that. That matters to me.
Yep. No, it, clearly I'm so happy for all the success. I'm excited to see, you know, what 2022 is going to bring for you, thank you for doing the work. Thank you for putting yourself out there, and thank you for being you.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I just love hanging out with you. So real quick, the book is on Amazon. It's called On the Vertigo, One Sick Man's Journey to Make a Difference. You can just click and buy it from any of my social media, or just go to Amazon, type in On the Vertigo, hit search, and you'll find my book. And real quick, for a cheap plug, we just released a special color hardback edition. So all the pictures are in color, and it's a hardback copy of that same book. But like the one you have, the pictures are black and white because we had to save cost. So now we release a hardback copy. If anybody's interested in that, that can be found on Amazon. And you can also get the Kindle version, which has color pictures on Amazon. So thanks.
Beautiful. Are there more pictures in the hardback version, or is it the same pictures just in color, better resolution?
It'll be all the same things. It'll be identical. They're just a color version.
Cool.
Which I think it's just better looking if you got the color version.
No, it is. And it brings it to life. And the pictures, it was cool that you included the pictures at the end of every chapter. And then at the end of the book, there's the rest of the photos. So I'm sure seeing them in color is just gonna bring that imagery and what you went through to life more vividly.
Yeah, I just really wanted people to be feel like they were on the trip. And so I just try to put pictures that mattered, you know, that kind of put you in my seat for that day or whatever. So yeah, the pictures were really important that I picked pictures and we put pictures in it, because I think that adds a lot to it.
Absolutely. Fantastic. I look forward to having you back again, Steve. And thanks as always for the time and the generosity and for being here.
Okay. I want to be your first third time guest. That's my goal.
We'll make it happen.
Okay. All right. Love you, brother.
Love you too, Steve.